Today's scripture reading is taken from the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 4, verses 1 to 12. That's Ecclesiastes, chapter 4, verses 1 to 12. Again, I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressor, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of their oppressors, and they have no comforter. And I declared that the dead, who had already died, are happier than the living, who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been, who has not seen the evil that is done under the sun. And I saw that all labor and all achievements spring from man's envy of his neighbor. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. The fool folds his hands and ruins himself. Better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. Again, I saw something meaningless under the sun. There was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. For whom am I toiling, he asked, and why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless, a miserable business. Two are better than one, because they have a good return for their work. If one falls down, his friend can help him up. But pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Through one may be overpowered, though one may be overpowered. Two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. This ends the reading of God's word. Thanks be to God.
So the last number of weeks we've been looking at the book of Ecclesiastes, one of the books which is known as a wisdom book, credited to Solomon originally, but as the book goes on, there are less allusions to Solomon, and it's the preacher, Koheleth, the preacher or teacher who is speaking to us. And he's giving Israel these teachings on wisdom. And just a little review of some key words. There is a contrast between life under the sun. That phrase, under the sun, is used a variety of times, 10, 12, 15 times through the book, so it's repeated. We see it a couple of references there. And under the sun speaks of a system where God is not a reference point. It's us living our lives one another, with one another, but God is not part of the picture. That's life under the sun. That contrasts with life under the hand of God. Nice reference in chapter 2, 24. Or also under heaven. So under the hand of God or under heaven contrasts with the first. And the second is a life lived with one another before God. So we recognize that God is there with us and he is Lord of the earth. He is indeed the rescuer for Israel, the rescuer for us. So there's a contrast between one system where God is not present under the sun, and then there's the second, which we saw living under the hand of God, which is where the writer is encouraging us. So that's the first set of words. Secondly, there's this focus on gain or advantage or profit. And gain is seen as humanity rushing after stuff or fame or power. It's not just things, but it's gain of advantage over the other. It's to be empowered over others. And of course, we see much of that striving for gain in our world, for sure. But it was the same in the days of Solomon, which takes us back 1,500 years before Christ. So it's a long way back. And then that contrasts with the word tov, which is good. What is good? And it's not always translated as good, but that's the idea. Good is contrasted with what is gain. So those are some of the words. That's where we've been going. If you're just coming in today, we'll see some of those thoughts as well. So what we see in chapter 4 is life under the sun with no reference to God. We're going to see God come back into the picture, if you like, by the writer in chapter 5. But here it's life under the sun, what life is like with no reference point to God particularly. But we'll see him still suggesting things as it goes on. So you note in this chapter, three times, verses 1, 3, and 7, we have this under the sun. So clearly the writer's going at that. What is life like under the sun? And it picks up with a suggestion from chapter 3, verses 16 and 17, which we didn't look at last week, but let me just read these two verses. This is the connection between chapter 3 and 4. Moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, wickedness was there, and in the place of righteousness, wickedness was there as well. And I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for he has appointed a time for every matter and for every work. So there is this recognition that there is wickedness, that there's unrighteousness, there's the lack of justice. That's where Koheleth, the preacher-teacher, is going for in chapter 4. So it begins with the theme that, you know what, we look around in our world and we see a lot of oppression. And so again, in this first verse in chapter 4, 1, we see the word oppression repeated three times. If something is repeated a bunch of times, means it's important. Again, I saw all the oppressions, note, that are practiced under the sun. Look, the tears of the oppressed, with no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power with no one to comfort them. So the writer is looking around and focuses on this aspect of oppression. And clearly, oppression is not unique to what happened in the time of Solomon. In the time of Jesus, there's much oppression with the Roman Empire and their desire to be an empire over the entire known world. And in our world today, all around the planet, there is much oppression. And so the writer is speaking to that. And so he emphasizes a few things. The oppressors have power and use it to dominate others. That's what we see in verse 1. They have power and they want to dominate so that their own needs are met. 2, the oppressors do evil to satisfy their own needs. That's all there in verse 1. So they dominate, they do evil, and then thirdly, the oppressed have no one to comfort them. In fact, the writer says in this model of under the sun, where if God does not exist, you know what, then maybe it's better not to exist at all. That's where he goes in the next unit. What's the point? With all those oppression, and I'm being oppressed, what's the point, the writer muses. So in the human story, that's what we see. So that's what the writer is saying. Oftentimes, we have the aspect or the thought that this is what Ecclesiastes is all about, so we don't even read it, because we think it's too much of a downer, so we don't go there. It recognizes that oppression is real. Note, in Ecclesiastes 5:8, this happens throughout the book. He keeps reminding us. Ecclesiastes 5:8, if you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violence of justice and right, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. So there's this pyramid of who's high and who has power and who dominates. But from a New Testament perspective, this is not a surprise. Because Jesus says the world is under the power of the evil one. That's the reality. John 12:31, John 14:80. Evil is real. There is much oppression. So I like what Henry Nouwen says on that in a little book called Beloved. The world lies in the power of the evil one. There's nothing new about that. We don't have to get panicky about the fact that there is so much evil. That's precisely what the world is all about. It's in the power of the evil one. St. John said that whilst in the world, we live with the mystery that the world is in the power of the evil one. That is why Satan says to Jesus, "You can have it all. It's mine anyhow." Jesus doesn't say that's not true. He says, but I don't want it. So the point is, how in a world that is evil do we create places that allow us to get a glimpse of God's goodness, of God's love? I'll read that again. So the point is, how in a world that is evil do we create places that allow us to get a glimpse of God's goodness, of God's love? There is much oppression. There is evil. So, you know, you can have a debate about humankind. You can have a debate about what is the fundamental temperament of everybody. Are people, is the world essentially good? Everybody's just good to one another? Or is there evil in our world and there is much oppression? Well, the biblical position is just saying that there is much evil. It's there. And oppression is there from age to age. Now, we have made many gains, right? There's lots of problems in the world, but also has been many gains. There is less world hunger than there has been. There is more people with education and being educated than there was. There is generally around the world better health than there was, but yet in the midst of it all, we know still that there's a lot of challenges, right? And we could be living in places which would just dismiss all that I've just said. It's not good at all. So that is this human story. That's the reality. Evil is there, and that's what the writer is beginning with. He's recognizing that oppression takes place. In the under-the-sun mentality, there is much oppression, because all I'm concerned about is how am I getting ahead? What's the situation for me going forward? I don't really care too much about everybody else. So what's the biblical response to that? Well, we see the scriptures teach us not to give into that, but to work for peace and to work for justice. Note from Amos, but let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. It's a beautiful unit there, that whole unit, which I didn't read. Justice, let it roll down like a mighty river. Proverbs, those who oppress the poor insult their maker, but those who are kind to the needy honor him. And then this great text from Micah, he has told you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. These are just examples of how we're not to give in to oppression, but that we are to work for what is good. That's the same word, tov, that the writer of Ecclesiastes is saying. Seek what is good, not just good for me, but good for others. So there's this pervasiveness of oppression, the writer says, verses 1 to 3. He introduces a connection with what we've been saying about gain, which is interesting, verse 4, that oppression is fueled by the seeking of gain. That's his argument. As we go about wanting more and more and more and more, it ultimately leads to oppression to other people. And so we see in verse 4, note what he says. This is quite an insight. Then I saw that all toil and all skill and work come from one person's envy of another. NRSV, it's another. In the NIV, it actually says one's neighbor. The envy of one's neighbor, I think that's stronger. I saw that all toil and all skill and work came from one person's envy of another or one's neighbor. This also is vanity, into chasing after wind. So as we try to climb the ladder of success, that frequently we are standing on the heads of other people to try to get there. It's a spirit of competition. And we've compared this with a spirit of abundance or a spirit of scarcity. Jesus teaches us a perspective of abundance. There's more than enough for everybody. If the world had that, we would be sharing with one another equally, nation to nation, country to country, we'd be sharing and not saying just what's good for me. As if it's good for me, then it's good for the planet. That's not the case necessarily. What's good for everybody? This is the theme of abundance rather than scarcity, where we have to think, hey, we got to make ourselves great again. We got to make our country great. It doesn't matter what everybody else happens to them. Not the biblical model. So this spirit of competition creates a lot of problems, and the writer says, actually, it's like breath. It's just like wind. It's just fleeting. It's gone. It doesn't help us. So gain driven by envy, something to think about. Envy drives this mad rush for getting ahead, a suspicion that others are gaining at one's expense. And so it raises the issue of who is our neighbor, who is the other? How do I relate to them, not just individually, but country to country? Obviously, it's a theme that our world needs to think through more and more and more. Do we see our neighbor as a competitor? Do we see our neighbor as one who may be getting ahead of me? And then I don't like that. The better way, the writer suggests, is to live more simply and to live in a contented manner and to experience tranquility. Note how he says, just thinking of under the sun mentality, what would be better? Fools fold their hands and consume their own flesh. Better is a handful with quiet than two handfuls with toil and a chasing after wind. So this theme of contentment, this theme of tranquility comes through in the text. Where does this challenge with the neighbor lead when we see each other all as competitors? The writer says it leads us to loneliness. It cuts us off from our neighbor. It leads us to a solitary life. And so we see the words in 7 to 9. This rings very true for our age. Again, I saw vanity under the sun, verse 7. The case of solitary individuals without sons or brothers, yet there is no end to all their toil, and their eyes are never satisfied with riches. For whom am I toiling, they ask, and deprive myself of pleasure. That word pleasure is actually good. Deprive myself of what is good. This also is vanity and an unhappy business. So when we live in this competitive spirit, we cut ourselves off from our neighbor. We cut ourselves off from other people. We live lonely lives, not satisfied with really what is good. So I don't know. I don't know what you think about that. Do we see the world as a world that is striving after gain? Do we see people isolated from others and who essentially are lonely? Because if we give in, you see, if we want to be the best, right? Which is nothing wrong with wanting to be the best at one level. It's whatever your work is, you want to aspire. Very good. But if you're going to be all depressed that there may be somebody else who may be just a little bit farther ahead of you, then that's not helpful. If you want to be number one, if you want to be the best hockey player in the entire world, and you note that, you know what, I'm not the best player. In fact, I'm not even in the top 100. I'm not in the top 500. Such a spirit of competition can create a lot of angst, a lot of sadness, whatever words we want. It creates loneliness. And so the writer puts that out for us. A miserable way to live, so the writer is saying. And so as we close this little bit, we have to pause and ask ourselves, okay, well, where am I at in this? How am I doing? Am I seeking after gain? Am I living in competition? Or am I okay with a sense of contentment and tranquility with less? We have to ask ourselves where we're at. But we do that all in a competitive world, right? We do it in a world where others are wanting to be number one, who want to rise. And so if I take the attitude, well, I don't necessarily want that, okay, but the rest of the world keeps moving. And so I really have to be okay that I'm not playing that game. The devil says to Jesus, I will give you the whole world, as Nouwen says. He doesn't say you're wrong. He says, well, you know what? The way you call the world, I don't want. So to have that attitude takes quite an insight into what the world is about. I don't need to play your games because I don't think your game is so great. Because you end up living lonely lives. You know, we have stories in the newspaper, stories of Canadian billionaires who end up their lives tragically. Why? Well, I bet you when the story is finally told, it's about money somehow. It's about who wants money, who wants some of their money. Billions. That story will ring. So we can have everything, and end up very tragically. It's not a model that works. So the writer Koheleth recognizes and says in Ecclesiastes 4, a long, long time ago, before we ever got into this craziness that where we are today. So what's an alternative view? Well, the writer suggests there is another way, and the way finds itself in community. And so we see here now in verses 9 to 12 as we end. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. The NRSV uses the word good there, good, because they know goodness there in their work. For if they fall, one will lift up the other. But woe to one who is alone and falls and does not have another to help. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And note again, verse 12, and though one might prevail against another, two will withstand one. And then a threefold cord is not quickly born. He introduces the sense of community. That there is a way that is better than this individual path where it's all up to me. We can live in relationship to one another. So not to live all alone, verse 8, introduces the new theme. Two are better than one. And then later he's going to say three are better than two. There's a new way of visioning the world where we don't have to give in to gain and oppression. We can live together, Koheleth says. There is goodness in that. And note the three areas where it's better to be in community. He says pitfalls on the journey. It's better to have two and be in community than not. The elements, facing the elements, better to be in community. Overcoming enemies, better to be in community. Three-cord rope is stronger, better. So he encourages us in that way. So there is power in community. And this is something that I think that should resonate with the church, because we as a church, the church is fundamentally called to be in community. The church is the community. Ekklesia, the Greek word, just means called out ones. The called out ones, that group, the called out ones, they are the church. And they are a group living in community. You read Acts 2, Acts 3, Acts 4, the whole piece is the community living together, being there for one another, helping us resist the oppression of the world to be a place of strength for us as we go forward. That is the church. So really, the church should be very good at forming community, because that's our practice, that's our experience. We've been doing this for 2,000 years. The church should be a pretty good place of community, because we're called to it, we're committed to it, we experience it. So then we can become a model for other people. We can show the world that indeed we are a community. Look, they live in community. Look how they love one another, the writers were saying. And so all that is our invitation to be together, support one another, and not simply live by the seeking after gain. So where do we go with it all going forward? Just 3 points. One, we need to reconsider our own individualistic path. We live in an individualistic world. There's a word, enculturate. Whatever world you live in is going to influence you. It's going to influence me. So we have to pause and we have to recognize, hey, this spirit of individualism beyond all might have some advantages in some ways, but ultimately is not a healthy way to live, to practice servanthood. So pause on that. Press the pause button. It's not a treadmill that we're on doing our own thing. We are living together. So secondly, we're called to pursue justice. It's why we sang that hymn just before the talk, is that we are not just concerned about ourselves, not as believers, not as people following Yahweh, Jesus Christ. No, Our Trinitarian God calls us to live compassionately with one another, where we value the rights of others and not just ourselves. So we can't just say, I want to make myself great. I want to make Canada great. Forget everybody else. How does that work? If everybody's saying that, then we're all at each other's throats. Doesn't work. We're called to embrace, biblically, to embrace the sojourner, to embrace the immigrant, to embrace the refugee, the displaced person. That's what the scriptures teach. In the Old Testament, if there was a sojourner, the stranger, the community of Israel had to take care of the stranger. That was part of it. You had to take care of the sojourner. You can't ignore them. You can't just say, you have no rights, good luck to you. No, Israel has to take care of the sojourner. So in our world, we are invited to receive, to receive. I told you last week, I think, I told the story of coming over, our family came over on the boat, right, from Belfast to New York City up to here. Well, we were one of thousands who came from Ireland as immigrants to be received by a country. So are you going to be received in a way that is friendly, or are you going to be seen as the enemy, see the someone I'm now in competition with? In our world, there's a lot of resistance to this. And then finally, we're invited to build community, to build community here. It's one of the best things we can do here at Weston Park, is to live in community, supporting one another, and then demonstrating that spirit of community to those around us. That's what we're invited to do. That's what the church is called to be. So we end with one little story from Jesus. If we turn to Luke 12, what does he say to this individual who's seeking after gain, who's seeking to have so much so that they can live comfortably and just relax? And so the story is of the rich farmer who has such superabundant crops that he comes up with a plan to build huge silos so that all my crops will be saved and that I'll be able to just live the good life. That's what he wants. Pick it up from verse 18. Then he said, I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build the larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and all my goods, all the focus on my. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. No, relax, eat and drink and be merry. Just live the good life and be comfortable. That's the spirit of gain. That's the spirit of competition. Verse 20, but God said to him, you fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves, but are not rich towards God or rich towards others in a spirit of competition, of compassion. So there is Jesus teaching his pause button. Be careful how you're building your life. And certainly when we go to the communion table, we are invited to see this downward way of Christ serving us, and then we are called to follow him and to imitate him in a concern for others. And so Ecclesiastes 4, I think, resonates pretty well with where we're at in our day, calling us to live with a theme on justice, a theme of care, a theme of compassion, not just me trying to get ahead. Forget everybody else. In Jesus' name, amen.